with a statement. This is May 21st, 1984. This is an interview with William Marshall, Bob Marshall. We're talking in his office in 1215 in the Wharf Building. I'm Laura Smale. You were born in Canada. What did your father do and your mother do? And what degree of education had they had?
Well, my father was also born in Canada, in London, Ontario. His profession while in Canada was in the newspaper business. And he was variously on the writer or reporter, I can't really remember, and worked in Syracuse, New
Would
York.
You just say that again? You said he was on the London Free Press.
London Free
okay.
Press.
Yeah.
He then went down to Syracuse, New York, where he met my mother, who was a nurse in a hospital in Syracuse. She is a Barnum, and as you know, most Barnums are related in this world, which includes P.T. and the Fultons, and maybe even back to Samuel Clemens. After they were married, they moved to Calgary, Alberta, where I was born in 1916, and then we moved to Vancouver, where I had about 3 years of elementary schooling before moving to Canada to Chicago in 1924, where I did most of my schooling through the second year in high school at San High. And then with the Depression, my father relocated with a company in Greenville, Michigan, a town of 5,000, with the Gibson Refrigerator Company. He was in the sales and marketing field. He was not technically trained, or that is, in engineering or science, and so there was no particular reason why my career should go in that direction. But it did happen that when I had been at high school in San High, I came under the influence of a very fine teacher, which happens on occasion to many of us, and had a great influence on my career. He created quite an interest in me in mathematics. Those were years, incidentally, when maybe not much different from today, when history teachers taught math or gym teachers taught chemistry. So it was just sheer good luck. I had a good teacher that was teaching a subject he understood and knew and could transmit to the students, and it was a great effect. He followed my career when I went to Greenville, and I graduated pretty much in the middle of the Depression in 1934, and the idea of going to college was quite new in my family. There was no history of higher education to my immediate in my immediate family, and the idea of proceeding on was strictly the result of the encouragement of a teacher. High school teacher that I had a great deal of respect for. And because of that, I studied for scholarship exams at Armour Institute of Technology, and was able to obtain a competitive scholarship and went to Armour Tech in 1934.
Why did you choose Armour Tech?
Well, that's a good question. I suppose I chose Armour Tech because this high school teacher knew one of the trustees of Armor Tech and was advised that this was an excellent school. And for some reason, I thought I would like a career in chemical engineering without even knowing what chemical engineering was. You must remember, in 1934, chemical engineering was only 26 years old as a profession, having really been founded in 1908. So there weren't many chemical engineers, and there weren't very many departments of chemical engineering in the entire United States. Armor Tech had one of the earliest, and here is where you tend to follow the advice of people you respect, and I entered that particular field. We moved back to Chicago, and I went to Armor Tech for 4 years, commuting on the elevated every morning from Rogers Park.
Were your parents pleased to have you going to college?
I think very pleased. Very pleased. They were delighted. Of course, the problem of financing my college still was a major one, and the scholarship wasn't enough, but my sister provided some help. She worked, and I also worked. This was a period of NYA, if you remember NYA, the National Youth Association or something.
Administration.
And so I would work for professors in mathematics, either grading papers or I learned English by grading papers for the English teacher. It was a great way to learn. Because you had to grade the papers of your colleagues and could see how terrible their writing was, and eventually you learned the English handbook of good writing. And
that's a new way of doing
helpful.
It. I would have thought you'd unlearn it.
Well, there were two things that helped then. One of the required courses in chemical engineering was German. And I think when you learn another language, you help learn English. And the other one was that I had to take Latin when I was in high school. And learning Latin, I have since realized, is the greatest way to learn.
Yes.
Learn English.
And this was part of that the tradition of it, even in small towns, there were people had Latin. Of course, you were in Chicago, but
it was required. And at times, you thought, "Gee, what in the world do I have to take this for?" And then there, believe it or not, it got so I rather liked taking it, and I found it to be value even today. Well, a very important event occurred in 1937. Since I was in chemical engineering, I had the great fortune of being a junior in the spring semester of 1937 when Professor Haugen came to teach at Armor Tech. One of the few times I understood that he ever took time away from Wisconsin. And he made such an impression on four of us in our class that in retrospect our whole careers were changed. He stayed in touch with us, and when we graduated he suggested going on to graduate school. Well, now that's quite an additional step to take in a family that had never basically, he has seen much more than high school.
Yeah.
And then the question might have been, well, is this necessary? But even in 1938, there weren't very many openings. And although DuPont interviewed me and was willing to offer a position, they recognized, the company recognized that there was great value in graduate work and said, all right, we'll talk to you 3 years from now. And indeed they did in 1941 when I accepted the position with them. But I came to Madison in 1938 along with one of my other classmates, And a whole new world opened up, because having gone to a basically a municipal or an urban school which had mostly commuters, you come to this very marvelous city where all kinds of freedoms, you no longer live with your family, you can do almost anything you wish, and it was is quite a experience. I had the good fortune of getting a room with Mrs. John D. Mack, Professor Mack's widow. Mm-hmm. I did not know at the time how fortunate that was, or what a marvelous 3 years I would have with a woman who knew the university so intimately and whose husband had been a prominent professor of mechanical engineering, and whose son later I would hire in the College of Engineering, Dave Mack.
You're not, this isn't the Mrs. Mack, the physics?
No.
Widow, I see, all right.
No. Well, there are two Macks.
I didn't realize that.
Now, she lived down on East Johnson. I think it's a home, she must have lived there nearly all her life in Madison. Till later. Well, during the 3 years in Madison, it was probably as delightful a time as I've ever experienced. Maybe I didn't appreciate it then. The campus was distinctly different from today. We worked in the old Chem Engineering building, and we watched the Union Theater being built. We attended the first performance there of Alfred Lunt and Lynn Fontaine and Taming of the Shrew, and we got our meals at the Union cafeteria for 99 cents a day. 33 cents in the morning, 33 at noon, 33 at night. We had a stipend as an RA of $60 a month. Saved money on it. Of course, you do that by paying only $5 a week for room and sending your laundry home to your mother. And it was quite a different kind of graduate work. Before this was before the war, this was before the explosion of science and technology, which created such a difference in the way you studied. I remember the capital budget for the chemical engineering department was $100 for the entire year, and was spent very frugally. Mm. I remember the year that Governor Heilby came into office and the telephones were removed from the campus.
Oh, I never heard that.
It was quite a sight, quite a thing to come down one day in old Haugen's office and see the phone gone from his wall.
How long did that last?
Well, it wasn't too long, but long enough to be very, very inconvenient. Maybe several months. And then while I was a graduate student, F. Ellis Johnson became dean of the college. The graduate students didn't have a great deal of contact with him, to the best of my knowledge. He talked to us once or twice, and the best recollection I have is he was emphasizing how important it was to have good health. Hmm. If you didn't have good health, you really weren't going to get anywhere in this world. Well, little did we know at the time he was saying that his wife was home very sick. Bad. No. He seemed to be a man who had a number of inconsistencies built into his makeup.
Actually, that sounds consistent to me. He must have been painfully aware of how important it was to be healthy.
Well, those of us that were graduate students, and I think it's true even today, didn't know a lot about the politics that were going on around us in the college. Maybe it's because we weren't right at the center of the physical center of where the dean's office was located, and maybe didn't overhear the gossip or scuttlebutt, which goes on so often, you know, in departments.
Yeah.
So I did not have a full appreciation of what kind of damage he was doing to the college until I returned some years later, heard of it later, or when I heard Ben Elliott's tapes the other day.
You thought of it as damage, did you, what he was doing?
Very much. Well, I don't, I guess I did then. And it's a little hard to distinguish what you were thinking then with what you really understood later. Sometimes your later memories you may attribute to
it seems
the
that
early experience.
Practically invariable as one of the weaknesses of oral history.
I suspect so. Well,
because Johnson presumably was trying to get more a higher academic standing for the engineering college, and this is what you were after. You were after a PhD.
I'm not sure that I could enunciate his educational philosophy very well. If I'm not mistaken, and I would have to check this, I think he was considering removing the shops from the college one time. Those were the shops that were out here on the ME building. Hmm. But I was surprised to hear from the Ben Elliott tapes that he had told the faculty that a number of them wouldn't be there the following year. And I guess what I miss in that is, what was the reason for the statement?
Yeah. I've gotten the impression that he was his mission was to upgrade the engineering college, and that the college had been in the doldrums in the 30s.
I think you're right. From what I know, the college had, from what I've been able to read in history, it had a number of deans that came out of so-called traditional fields, which could have been largely civil or related areas, and these fields were not noted for their research activities or the kinds of things that would be done in an academic situation to improve the standing of the profession, whereas what I saw was quite a different situation in chemical engineering. And I think you have to recognize that one of the reasons chemical engineering has assumed the stature at Madison was due to the research that was done in the department as early as the 20s.
Mm-hmm.
And that's was a very rare thing in those years. Research
yes.
in engineering was pretty limited.
Yes, I've got that
limited.
Impression. Mm-hmm. But this wasn't true in chemical engineering.
In chemical engineering, there was active research in the 20s. In fact, some of the truly pioneering research was done by Haugen Watson and the student of Olaf's, Alan Colburn, who really became world-renowned for the research he continued at DuPont after he left. To the chemical engineering student of those days, Colburn was a household name, mm-hmm. as was Haugen. But they did some very basic research, and more importantly, they wrote the books which formed the basis for chemical engineering education.
Mm, that's what Haugen said in his interview.
There's no question. Even today, when Haugen can make meetings of chemical engineering profession, people come up to shake his hand to say, well, I've used your book. I've never had the chance to meet you, and what a great honor. And this occurs all over the world whenever he can attend these meetings, which is not as frequent now. So I felt very good about the chemical engineering department, and I think the faculty were different. There possibly is another reason why chemical engineering was ahead. It is closely tied to chemistry. And in those years, and even today, there are chemical engineering departments that are part of the chemistry department, or vice versa. Mm-hmm. They're coupled. They're not even in engineering colleges. It's true at Illinois. It's true at Berkeley, and a few other places. So the habit of doing research was easily transferable from people who were in chemistry and worked with chemical engineers. Haugen's great claim to fame was his ability to translate physical chemistry into chemical engineering applications. His insight as to how you would apply the principles of physical chemistry to chemical engineering processes and equipment design and things of that kind. He was extremely insightful into where an industrial problem could benefit from the application of basic principles. Well, I left the department in 1941. And
I'd like to ask you some more questions about
sure.
it. I wonder if you could say, to begin with, in what way Haugen made such an impression upon you at Armor Tech?
Well, I can give you one example, which always stands in my mind. We were struggling with a book that had come out recently called Unit Operations, written by two authors from Michigan, Badger and McCabe, and we were, you know, as most students are with something new, we really were having our troubles in understanding some of the mathematics, the equations and so forth. And I think the first or second lecture that Haugen was there, he was looking at the book, and he says, really, that information is something that you should be able to derive from principles. And he shut the book and threw it on the table and said, now you go about it this way. And the insight he had into these principles that he could take and derive without even having had a book to look at, I think just hit all of us right square between the eyes.
I can imagine.
And the thing that really was impressive is that he simply knew. He wasn't in any position where he had to bluff on anything. And if something came up that was new to him, he'd sit down and derive it. I've seen him do this. Mm. And there's a genius in his ability to translate the physical thing into mathematical terms and then develop it much more broadly than maybe the simple beginnings of what the books gave us. Well, the other thing is he had a fantastic sense of humor. And he'd love to tell stories, usually about on himself, something that might have been apparently embarrassing. He'd love to tell about it, or he'd get and he still tells stories about his time down there, how the students would have a good time with him, and how on the last day there they rolled in a piano and played On Wisconsin for him, and these were great things, and he just had a rapport with students that I think we all have experienced it with somebody somewhere. But I think the thing that I don't know, these are the ingredients. He was intelligent, he was very humble, and he was very humane. He would help students in any way, in anyone, it didn't make any difference who they were or what their problem, he would help them. And it doesn't take long before this is deeply appreciated by students, and the students want to be with him. So that's maybe the best way I can tell you.
So, and he got to know you and encouraged you to come to UW to apply for a, you got an RA-ship from the beginning, did you?
Yeah. Well, I got to know Olaf a little bit better than just in the classroom because I discovered he liked to play golf, so we went out and played golf while he was there, and he really enjoyed that for 50 cents a day. And that continued throughout our association. He thoroughly enjoyed it, and we had many good times together.
So he wanted you here as a golfing partner.
I often wonder why he ever wanted me to come, but because I wasn't that much of a student, but he certainly made it possible. Then, of course, he was the reason I returned after the war.
Yes, I
basically.
But still, he took you on right away as his graduate student. And how, he had a lab, did he?
Yes, if you want to call that old building. I don't know if you were ever in it. I think it used to be for anatomy. I'm not sure the full history of it. They used to...
This is the building that was where Helen White is now.
Right. Mm-hmm. 600 North Park.
Yeah.
An old building, massive walls, horribly chopped up. I don't know that it was ever intended to be used for what we used it for. But... when you say he had a lab, yeah, there were some labs up on the top floor where he did some of his research. And I had a lab on the second floor. And there were all of 5 graduate students in chem engineering then.
Oh, is that all?
That's all. So when you talk about, you know, labs, it's nothing like today where you have buildings that are laboratories throughout.
I was thinking of biochemistry, which I have a fairly vivid picture of how that operated in the 1930s, and I was just trying to get a comparison.
I don't think that's possible.
Mm.
The kinds of research done in those years were so dramatically different from the research today. You generally think of the laboratories today as being filled with these very fine, precise instruments, with computers,
mm-hmm.
with lots of glassware and lots of other stuff. Our chem engineering labs were basically rather crude, but they were developing some of the most basic chemical engineering data that has come out of laboratories.
Hmm.
In the general fields of what we call heat and mass transfer. So you'd see some rather crude looking things like a glass column with what we call Rashid rings, and you'd have water flowing one direction and gases flowing in another, and you measure the rates at which these components were absorbed, and these are all based on the kinds of things that went on in the chemical industry. The measurements were, I won't say crude, but approximate to say the best. The measuring devices that later years hadn't even been invented.
But you didn't feel they were at the time, presumably.
Oh no, we thought this was all pretty good. But No, it's really hard to imagine that that was even called research then, because the war created a change that today you have to sit down and think about just to fully comprehend what happened. Between the period of 1941 and when I came back, well, the world dumped upside down on December 8th. It hadn't dumped upside down earlier. And the advances that were being made during those years are obviously dramatic when you had the introduction of the principles of radar, the Manhattan Project, which led to whole new methods of measurements of radioactivity and all the instruments, and then the computer began to come in the late 40s.
I mean, you had classes, presumably. You had some classes.
Oh, yes.
You took chemistry,
yes.
Did you?
Oh, yes.
Who did you take chemistry with?
My minor was in physics. And I took classes from Ingersoll. And no, wait a minute. Physics and math. So I took classes from Ingersoll, from March, from Sokolnikov. And then the courses being given in chem engineering had so much chemistry in them.
Mm-hmm.
But there wasn't much of a need to take the usual chemistry course. First of all, a chem engineer, even in those years, took as much chemistry in his undergraduate as a chemist. And I had taken all that at Armour.
Mm-hmm.
And so what I really was doing here was to get the courses in chem engineering that had never been taught down at Armour because of the developments of Haugen,
mm-hmm.
Watts, and Raggetts. They had these courses that we missed so badly down there. No, we did research. We published. In fact, I did an extra bit of research, although it was not on the thesis at all.
Mm-hmm.
It was related to a problem that the National Research Council, I think, asked him to do for a war effort on the adsorption of gases. And we came out with a rather novel mathematical analysis of how moisture adsorbs on these different desiccants, which was a forerunner, really, of all this chromatography work.
Was this a case where he would have an idea and then you would...
Your question,
yeah.
The problem we worked on was really, as I say, something that he had been asked to do, but it so often happens, you know, you involve students,
mm-hmm.
to work with,
yeah.
you, and I worked with him on the analysis of, or trying to find mathematical solutions to the problem,
so
and
this,
it seemed to work out pretty.
You weren't in dealing with, well, you were dealing with materials, but you were more dealing with the figures then.
That it was really all figures.
Mm-hmm.
We got all of the data from the literature, and we used the data and applied it to
mm-hmm.
the theory. And the research I worked on wasn't very glamorous in those days. It was on the drying of solids, which was a major process in industry, and one I continued to pursue well after I left the university.
Was this something that had that was being done for a particular industry?
No. No, it's just the fact that in nearly every chemical industry that manufactures almost anything, there's a process somewhere along the line where you have to remove liquids or water, and that's a very expensive and time-consuming. It led me into my future research interests here of atomization and spray drying and studying the process of drying materials in particulate form, like coffee, milk, among other things.
Yes, that's a
Except it led us into the spray drying of bacteria during the early 50s, which was in biological warfare. So.
Oh, yes.
I'd be run out of here in today's climate. But we didn't draw any pathogens. It's really a very basic problem as to how can you remove the water from bacteria and keep them alive. And it had lots of useful applications.
And it wasn't the same as freezing them.
No, we did that too, though.
Right.
We did freeze drying
yeah.
later. That's when I came back.
What do you think has been arranged?
Are they, is she coming
down in a few minutes?
Oh, okay.
But I guess getting back to when I finished the research, or finished my degree, DuPont was back, and I'd interviewed.
Yeah.
And I went to Wilmington.
Yes. I'm still trying to find out a little bit more. You see, I'm coming from a scene in the life sciences where the students are working until midnight and are in the office at 7 o'clock on Saturday morning. And I'm just curious as to how the life of a chemistry engineering graduate student compares to that chemical engineering.
Well, I don't think it was too different. I had a lab in the building. I had some experimental equipment that was brought from industry, and I did a fair amount of experimentation. As I say, today that research work, I'm afraid, would look like a pretty elementary master's.
Wouldn't that be true in any kind of research work? Do you think it's more particularly true for what you were doing?
Laura, let me tell you what I have observed over the years, that in those early years in the 30s and 40s, and I guess I'll use the term, many of us had the good fortune of working in areas that had never been explored in any systematic research way. Now, the good fortune is that whatever you've learned was new.
Yeah.
As time went on and more studies were made, then you had to refine your work. You had to become more precise. You extended it into regions which weren't easily reached. And then the work got more difficult, and the instrumentation got more expensive. And sometimes the results weren't nearly as significant as they were when you made these first early experiments and could get data rather readily, which could
which
be used all.
Which nobody had ever known before.
That's right. Mm. And of course, future researchers show, well, sure, we may not have gotten everything, and therefore they started refining how it was done. Measurements were made more accurately. But the principles came out. And as I look back, I think a lot of them are rather sophisticated approaches to understanding what was going on without the future real precision of insight. And this was Haugen's great contribution. He had an intuition. And we used what were known as correlations. We would correlate phenomena that we observed with certain physical parameters or certain process parameters, and we were able to prepare design charts, which engineers could then use to get certain coefficients, let us say, to design large-scale equipment. Now, prior to having those coefficients, or prior to having these rather crude experiments, they had to do an awful lot of guessing or put lots of safety factors in. The work I was doing, as I say, was in the area of drying. Today we call it mass transfer. But we did learn some rather interesting principles of how to predict the rates at which moisture was lost in the solids, how the effects of the physical arrangement affected the rates.
You did this by observation?
In experiment.
Hmm.
And then the question came, you know, what might be some common principles that develop from here? Well, I was working on the first work, really, that it was done on packed beds for drying. And I think the paper was fairly pioneering, because from that early work, there were at least two other theses that became landmark theses.
Hmm.
And they weren't referred to as drying, they were referred to as heat and mass transfer in packed beds. But the principles were extended from there into catalytic work. And they're still working on these problems even today. But they're so far down the road on new insights, because today they are looking at the molecular surfaces of the particles. They're looking at all kinds of fine structure, as I call it, that in those years we couldn't contemplate because we didn't know how to measure it. We didn't have an insight.
So you were sort of in the position that people who were around 1900 in genetics were working on things that would seem impossibly cool today, but I gather that those were first breakthroughs.
I think there's
then,
a similarity.
And that must be very exciting.
It's a similarity. Of course, it's maybe even more fascinating to do it in retrospect, because in those years, you know, you didn't know what was going
yeah.
to grow. Now you begin to realize, with all that wisdom, that research has the potential for coming up with many unexpected things, as long as people continue to do it. And any time I hear it being proposed that we stop research, that research isn't needed or isn't necessary, it's a very disturbing thing to hear, because there's so many examples today where the continued research has improved devices, especially in the medical field, where there was a time when advocacy said, stop doing this, it's too expensive.
Mm.
Of course it's expensive. But if you don't spend the money, you'll never get it cheaper.
Yeah.
So,
I was going to look at my chart to see who was here, because were the other members of the faculty equally interested in this, in research?
In engineering?
Mm. In chemical engineering, yes.
Well, yes, there was a, of course, the one faculty member who did research, O.P. Watts, you know, Watts mm-hmm. did pioneering work in electrochemistry on the corrosion of metals.
Well, this Kowalki Watts.
Kowalki was not as great a researcher. Raggis did some research in metallurgy. Haugen, of course, was always
Krompholz.
John Krompholz did research in metallurgy. He later went on to be chief metallurgist, I think, at Weirton Steel.
So except for Kowalki and Raggetts, then this was a very small department.
Of course, when I came back, our research activities gradually accelerated.
Did your fellow students, graduate students in the late 30s, did you talk together? Were you doing enough the same thing so that you could talk together and get ideas from each other, or wasn't that part of your learning?
Oh, sure. There's a fair amount. We had what were called research seminars, you know, and they'd give the seminars very much as today about the research that they were doing.
This is just in chemical engineering, or does it take in others in engineering also?
Well, it was principally chemical engineering. They used to have some faculty seminars, I recall. They were held in the old hydraulics lab. But they were more seminars on engineering practice. They would have professional engineers come in and speak in the evening. It was not a heavy research activity in the college.
Any at all, except, I mean, really very little at that time. I get it.
There were some, I should say that they had research of sorts in sanitary engineering.
Mm-hmm.
I think I don't remember if Kessler was here then, or was he there when I came back? That's the problem. There was an element of research back in the early years, I believe, in civil engineering. But there were more studies of performance of equipment like water wheels or turbines, things of that kind. Research in those years in engineering was not research as we know it today.
Yeah. Except in chemical engineering.
I would say chemical engineering was different. It was developing new principles. It was developing an insight and understanding in the phenomenon. But too often, what went as engineering research was testing something to see how it performed. Maybe an element of an engine or a material to see when it would fail. Now today you can do the same thing, but then you're going to study material behavior much differently. You'll look at molecular structure.
Yes.
You'll get insights as to why things fracture.
You can see what happens, but you can find out why also.
You've got the instrumentation to do it. You've got the measuring devices. Things happen to materials very quickly, and we didn't have the high-speed cameras or the devices which would record something in nanoseconds.
Did you take any other courses on campus except in the sciences? I don't suppose you would as a graduate student.
Not really. It was a simple life.
Mm-hmm.
There was no TV.
Yeah. What did you do for fun?
Went over and played pool in the Union. Or we would go out maybe hiking. It's just interesting to reflect on those years, how rather tranquil life was.
It must have been.
It really
was. Well, of course, I know
really
my
was.
Car was
we,
there, too.
I didn't have a car.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if any of my friends had cars in those years.
And you had enough to, you didn't have to work. Well, you had your RA ship. Yes,
the
I'm
RA
missing out.
The RA was enough.
With undergraduates, it's quite different with a graduate student.
You know, not to speak of, they had a college social life, if you want to call it. The wives, they had a group called Pentagon.
Oh, yes, I've heard about that.
And they would have something once a year. The dean didn't do anything that I can remember. And
did Haugen ever have you out to supper?
Yes. Kowalki held a seminar, which is semi-social, and if you didn't go, you were in trouble.
Did you like him?
Otto Kroenke?
What kind of a teacher was he?
Yeah, I guess so. He was he really was a high school teacher type. He did come out of, I think, high school teaching.
Oh.
And was a disciplinarian. And tended to be the kind of, in contrast to Haugen, who you tended to not seek out.
So you weren't a grown-up in his class? You mean if you talked, he would...
Well, no, I mean, he wasn't the kind that that you could feel comfortable with, and he tended to be the kind that would try to find a lesson in anything that happened to your work.
Mm. Yes.
Very gruff.
Very painful.
I remember one time when one of my college graduate students had had to turn off the compressed air for his research, and he forgot to turn it back on, and that controlled the heat in the building. Mm. Kowalki came in the next day, and his office was 120 degrees, I think. he was kind of, you know, that would make something out of that. He'd really get angry. Ball out too, whereas I imagine if that had happened to Haugen, he would have said something, but he might have made quite a joke about it.
Mm.
Later on, would recount it as a humorous story. But Kowalki was a very, very tough-minded person, with himself and others.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very, very. He was a actually a great friend of the students.
Oh.
In general, he served on a number of committees on the campus for the benefit of students, I think. I'm not sure now whether it was a dormitory committee or what it was, but he was a very fine person, but the kind that I don't like to say that students would be frightened of, but they wouldn't feel real easy for them because...
He sounds a bit like Steenbach. What I hear of Steenbach. Although I guess Steenbach was perhaps considerably... once you got to know him, I guess he was a friendly, likable person, but he was very forbidding.
Of course, later when I returned and was no longer a student, quite enjoyed Otto. He was quite friendly with me. As you know, he outlived his insurance. There's a piece in the paper, I think, at the time that he reached a certain age where no longer to... Well, I think it's a case where he didn't have to pay anymore.
Oh, I see. I thought you meant he didn't get it anymore.
No, no.
Really frightening. They're not here yet, I guess.
No, no.
Well, what was it like at DuPont? Is that something you can describe briefly?
In those years...
Think of yourself as coming from the Midwest.
In those years, Laura, the DuPont, where I went, was a mecca for any chemical engineer, industrial mecca. I went to the engineering experiment station in Wilmington,
mm-hmm.
and the specific group was called the technical division. It was under the direction of one of the renowned practicing chemical engineers, T.H. Chilton. It was also where Alan Colburn went to work when he left. And it was, well, due to Chilton, I think, it was just full of very prominent chemical engineers who had made themselves famous through their publications and through their research.
So you must have done very well to get a job there then.
Well, I felt very sort of humbled about it, to go there and sit down at a desk where the names on the mailboxes were the famous names I've read about as a student, and now you sit down and see them in front of you. And, of course, I wasn't there more than 3 months when Pearl Harbor, that changed everything that was going on. And we were all caught up in different kinds of work, because clearly DuPont was an important chemical company for all aspects of the war effort. And I remember in early 42, in one of our pilot plant is where you have chemical equipment on a mid-scale between lab and plant, and they had a large column there, and they started distilling water, and we could not figure out what the world was happening. And then certain prominent chemists began to come to the, and they were, and you began to associate the chemists with their fields, and many of us were not privy to knowing, but you start to deduce what was going on. And to a degree, although it wasn't until the tests in New Mexico that it was fully brought home that great numbers of the of your colleagues had been pulled off to other. They started leaving. That was the other thing. They leave and go to Chicago Met Lab or out to Hanford in Washington.
But you didn't know where they were going, or did you? I mean, did they?
Well, some of them knew where.
But you didn't know about the tests in New Mexico, did you?
Not until after.
Yeah.
But it wasn't, well, in the meantime, most of us that were there were going ahead. We did research in there, by the way. This was a technical division, but we also were called on to help in the solution of plant problems. So I visited a lot of DuPont plants to help on solving operating problems of the plants, which was very extremely interesting. And I probably didn't appreciate it as much as I have since, but DuPont was simply a great company to work for. They really had outstanding management. They had far and away the best approach to safety. Safety to them was number one long before it got this big play in. It seemed, anyhow. Their management just simply recognized that if things weren't safe, it was bad business and bad everything. So we were very much conditioned to the practice of wearing safety glasses, and they had a safety department that was the final say on any plant that was built. They were the ones that decided whether or not it met the standards of the company. The people that they brought into DuPont were, in my judgment, all very, very high-level types, very, very professional. They had good employment practices. There was no union. And I've had many continuing good relations since leaving them.
So why did you leave?
Well, I'll tell you, when the war was over, everything was changing. There was change within the company. There was reorganizations going on that you wondered about. But principally, Olaf asked me to come out here and take a look and see if I'd be interested in coming back. And that happened to many DuPont employees. Or sought to go back.
Yes, because the colleges were in desperate need of people.
And so there's quite an alumnus out there. Of course, many of them have retired too.
Mm-hmm.
And we decided we'd come back, and so we came. I came in winter.
You were married by then?
Yes, I had two children. My wife had just had an operation, so I left her in Wilmington and drove out to Madison in the first car we ever owned. Not many people were driving during the war out there.
So you didn't have any question about coming back to the university, to a campus? Well, your salary, was that equal?
No.
Well, why did you, what was attractive to you about it?
I think it's because the change occurring within DuPont created enough uncertainty about whether I wanted to remain there, plus the fact that I really was attracted to the academic environment.
Oh, so I see. When you say change, you mean in the management in the policies.
Yes, and the reorganization right within.
So it wasn't that the kind of work you were doing was changing. It was that you. I see. So you might not have liked working there.
Financially, it was it wasn't as bad a change as it would be today for somebody to move back. It was not too bad. Plus the fact that I had an assured consulting arrangement with a company in Philadelphia that I'd gotten acquainted with at DuPont. That was enough to make the differential up.
That's right. Hogan worked every summer for an industry here or there, didn't he?
Pretty much. Mm-hmm.
And one forgets that there were other ways of adding to one's income.
Well, there were a lot of things about the academic environment that at that time was especially favorable to the other things.
Oh, I had to do them both. Okay. Tell me, how did you happen to get Bird, Lightfoot, and Stewart here?
I would have to give a major part of the credit to Professor Haugen. Now, as you know, Bird had done his doctoral work at Wisconsin.
Oh, that's right.
Under Joe Hirschfelder. Mm-hmm. So he knew about us, and he did his work in physical chemistry. So we did not know him as well in chem engineering, except one of my early graduate students, Bill Rands, and Bob Bird, when he was a grad student, were quite chummy, and I got to know Bob when he was a grad student here and thought very highly of him. Warren Stewart had been a graduate of Wisconsin undergrad, and then went to MIT and then went to Sinclair. And I'm sure that Olaf Haugen always was watching Warren because he's a brilliant student, brilliant engineer, and I'm pretty sure that Olaf Haugen was hoping to lure him to Wisconsin, if I could use that. Lightfoot came because of the effort that Professor Haugen made to establish the field of biochemical engineering, and that was fairly early in the decade. I think around 50 or 51, there was established a Bachelor of Science degree in biochemical engineering.
Mm-hmm.
And there was nobody in the department who was particularly experienced in the field, and Olaf became aware and acquainted of Professor Lightfoot. I think he was working at Pfizer at the time, and I remember at the time he was invited out I first met him.
Yes, sir. Well, you were talking about Lightfoot.
Okay,
I partly Lightfoot. Had in mind, though, whether You say that Haugen was responsible for thinking about them and getting them. Did he consult with the rest of the department? Were you all in agreement, or wasn't an issue at all? You just didn't think about.
I tell you, Haugen sometimes would not consult. It's strange now, as I look back on it, that there wasn't any serious unhappiness about it. I don't know whether there was a different feeling at that time, or whether it was because Haugen was such a magnificent person in his own right, and that there was never any feeling that he was doing something that was not for the good of the department. Mm-hmm. There was no selfishness in his makeup.
But in fact, nobody was unhappy about it.
Nobody was unhappy. And then as time went on, now I think it's very important to know that Haugen had some very clear-cut objectives in his mind, and I think that may be a problem today with the department, that is not as clear-cut among the faculty as it was in his era. He saw very clearly what he considered to be the important needs of chemical engineering in the future. And the biochemical engineering he saw as an important need in the fermentation industry. Unfortunately, that program never went the way he'd hoped. The degree disappeared after time because undergraduates really did not want a biochemical engineering. They just wanted a chemical engineering degree. But he felt that somebody with Lightfoot's background was important to the department's future programs. And he saw in Bird the strength that he would bring from his knowledge of the work he had done with Hirschfelder and others in theoretical chemistry, and how they could be translated into chemical engineering. The next person that he looked at seriously was Kirk. Well, I wouldn't say the next. I should say another person that he was very anxious to have develop in the department into a specialist in organic chemical engineering processes. He saw that there was a great need to understand those processes that involve organic chemicals, and these could be biological, and he felt that somebody should begin to develop that in the same way that unit operations were developed for the physical processes.
And Kirk,
it never happened. Kirk didn't respond, and he was encouraged to go into industry.
It's curious, in Haugen's history, he says that only, as I understood him, only one professor who got tenure in the department ever left it for another teaching position. Although, on the same page, he mentions three people who did leave for other teaching positions, and I wonder if maybe there may have been a misprint there. De Benedetto, for instance, left.
Yes, that was a little later.
Yeah. Anyway, it's not terribly important, but
De Benedetto would have been here until 64.
Mm-hmm.
And he said three others.
Well, just he named three people who would. Well, I can. You have the history. Well, how long did this amiability in the department and the willingness to let Haugen pretty much decide what directions things should go in? How long did that go on?
Well, it was going on when I came back. It was going on when I was there. After Professor Haugen took over the chairmanship, when I guess when I came to Kowalki was still chairman. Well, from the time that Haugen became chairman and the procedure was that he was chairman until he wanted to take a year or two off to do research, and then Professor Raggetts became chairman. Mm-hmm. And the department was very happy with that. Mm-hmm. They were very happy to have Haugen or Raggetts, because it meant that the others didn't have to.
Yeah.
And then, of course, the day came when Haugen reached retirement, or close to it, and he left to become the science advisor to the ambassador to Sweden. And I believe he did that in the last 2 years before 70, or he may have done it a couple of years prior to that. But then at the time he left, then the chairmanship was taken over by Professor Raggetts.
Well, let's see, Bird became chairman in 64, but...
Well...
Yeah, I see, but Raggetts presumably...
Raggetts was chairman, I assume,
until then.
Some years prior to that. Now, when did Raggetts retire?
Well, he seems to... Until 71, he seemed... I have him.
Well, that's true. Bird had the chairmanship, and Raggetts worked with him very closely. As a matter of fact, I think Raggetts, now that I look back on it, did not want to continue as chairman and was very happy to have Bird take it over, but he gave him invaluable assistance more as an associate chairman. Because I remember those years that Raggetts did a lot of things for the college in many ways, such as chairing our scholarship committee, being responsible for funds from the Ford Foundation for forgivable loans for young faculty. So he was busy with that, and Bird was involved in the chairmanship.
Were you still going to department meetings?
Well, yes.
You kept on being active.
Yes, as a matter of fact, I still had graduate students up until about 1962 or 3.
Hmm. Does there come a point where the department becomes more official and it gets bigger and you do have regular department meetings or not?
Oh yes, the department got into the pattern of regular department meetings in the 60s, as I recall. It could have been earlier. The need for department meetings clearly became much more evident and obvious as time went on, I suppose beginning in the 60s as the university got more and more rules and regulations and policies to follow, and then more legalistic about the way things were done. And of course, that's been more so in the last 10 years.
Were there any separations of opinion as to what kinds of people should be brought in or on salaries?
Well, not so much on salaries as on subject area. I'm trying to recall. I think it was when Raggetts was still chairman in the early 60s.
Uh-huh.
I served the department in the form of being responsible for the searching for new faculty. Mm-hmm. And so I did spend time with the faculty trying to get out of them what they felt were the important directions the department should go. In fact, I instituted a procedure which everybody seemed to think was a good thing, and that was to hold a departmental dinner once a month, where we went to the union and had dinner, and then the practice was that each person in there would present some views on whatever the issue was.
This was a department meeting, or in addition to the department meeting?
It was a separate one. It was devoted simply to the one question of what our needs were and directions to go. And I believe Professor Regas took the minutes, and we always set it such that it, precisely at 9:30, regardless of who was talking or where he was, we quit. So it wouldn't go on. And I think in those years we had some very worthwhile discussions. I think it was that time that we brought Langer in. Coberly came in through a quite different route. And Rudd came in, and Bowen.
Well,
they did not be 1996.
These are approximate. They're approximately right, I think. Well, you mean that they weren't discussed by the department? They came in some other way?
Let me tell you just two here that are unique. And they're unique. And this is another kind of a story, but I might as well put it in here. During the period from 1953 on until I became dean, I was so-called executive director of the engineering experiment station. At the time I took the station over, it had a lot of authority to make appointments. Among them was the authority to make tenure track.
My goodness.
Yes.
I didn't know that.
My goodness. I made three during that time. First one was Duffy. Mm-hmm. Second one, I'll get this, was my old high school teacher from a Chicago high school. And he was brought in with the title of Professor of Engineering Education. And he was brought in for the chief purpose of running our superior student program, mm-hmm. which was intended to find outstanding students in the high schools. Mm-hmm. And working with the School of Education, which turned out to be virtually impossible. And the third one was Coberly. And I brought him in as a, I brought him in with tenure, associate professor, without any departmental home. And it wasn't, in Duffy's case, it shows that he was not a member of the department. If this date is right, until 1966.
Well,
which is about 12 years after he came into the engineering experiment station.
I see.
His,
that's very interesting.
His, and he, of course, during that time made quite a name in the solar energy laboratory. Mm-hmm. Right about 1954, Farrington Daniels came to my office in the experiment station and said we ought to do some research in solar energy for underdeveloped countries. he didn't think the kind of research he was doing on photosynthesis was really the direction he wanted to go, and he thought they ought to have engineering applications. So we agreed, and he was getting money from Rockefeller for this. So he was getting the money, and I was going to get the facilities and try to find somebody to run the program, and that's when I got Jack Duffy, who had just gotten out of the Navy,
mm-hmm.
and he had been my PhD back in 1951 or so. He was on his way to Kimberly-Clark to interview, and I told Jack he ought to stop by and play a game of golf. He never got to Kimberly-Clark.
Was he already interested in solar energy research?
I don't think he...
But you just thought he was so good that you wanted to have him there.
Well, he had the necessary qualifications. After all, solar energy research is not a esoteric thing. I mean, you're dealing with radiation, you're dealing mm-hmm. with heat transfer, you're dealing with everything a chemical engineer has learned.
Yeah.
Thermodynamics and all the rest of it. And Jack, I knew, was competent as a researcher, and so that's how he came into the experiment station. And he worked, of course, on that program for some years. We did a great deal. Long before, you know, the solar energy was this big thing with all the environmentalists and everybody else, we had done nearly everything in our laboratory. And then the space age sort of knocked the work out, because then solar was being studied in industry in a totally different manner. And our work sort of fell by the wayside, and Jack became director of UIR in about 65. Then after he was director here, he went to the grad school to be associate dean, and then solar picked up, as you can well imagine, in the late 60s, early 70s, with the energy crisis, that thing
momentarily
blew up all over again. But during this time, the chemical engineering department became aware of Duffy again and recognized that he'd be a good member of the department, so they voted him in to be a member of the chemical engineering department.
Were any eyebrows raised anywhere at the president's office, for instance, when you brought people in? That's the first time I've heard of this.
It's not the only place it was being done, Laura. They were making them in the library.
But where
Butts had a tenure appointment in the student union.
Yeah.
And somewhere in the latter part of the 60s, middle 60s, maybe, somewhere right after Coberly had come, it just took away all that. Clodius, I think, was the person responsible during Harrington's time, and those privileges were removed. Now, at the time, I thought, well, maybe they should, and maybe they should. But I look back on it, it's just a shame that there is not a place of that kind where you could bring people in that you know are very well qualified, but you can't bring them through a department because departments all have their priorities.
Yeah, it was a very painful case of that in zoology recently.
And so, if it's done with a great deal of care and quite infrequently, my experience and my conclusion is that it works, but the reason I say that is that the ones that I brought in ultimately became a member of a degree-granting department.
Mm-hmm. They would have stayed on anyway, whether they had or not. But
oh yes, they would have stayed because you can't take it away.
Yes, yes.
And we have a few holdovers of that kind in the university. The head of our engineering library has tenure without any department.
Well, that's slightly different, but some...
How different? I don't know. You see, they got very, very strict on this idea that you have tenure in a department, and then the department gets defined by having courses, curricula.
Mm. And the person teaches.
This is where there's such a terrific battle over the formation of IES, the Institute for Environmental Studies.
Because they weren't tenure granting.
Well, they wanted it.
Yeah.
And they've done it. They have made one or two down there that have been on tenure track in IES. I'm not sure how it was done. Well, the next person I appointed in the station was Hughes. I brought him here. But to do it, I had to get him an appointment in chemical engineering. They had to agree that he would have a 10-year home, but they didn't pay any salary.
Oh. And they were willing to do that?
Yes. Hughes had an excellent reputation. He had gotten his PhD at MIT. He had been out at Shell Development for years. He knew the academic community. In fact, he used to interview here to hire our people. And then Shell went through this big change in their research centers. They closed them down out at Emeryville. And his future was to go into some plant operation down in Texas or Louisiana. Well, a lot of universities were very anxious to try to get him for faculty member. And I was able to attract him here, and at the time, it had to be done differently. I could not just say I'm going to do it and do it. I had to get the chemical engineering department to make the agreement. And now, of course, he's back in there full time because of other changes that took place after Dean Bollinger came in. So it's a bit of a meandering account of some of the appointments that have come into chemical engineering. And you know, as you asked me the question about was there uniform agreement on these things, I have to say that in the earlier years, in the 50s and the 60s, there was not the same rigidity of voting a person in that there is in today's environment, where you have to, they have spelled out what, how many out of so many voting have to say yes in order to approve.
Mm-hmm.
And it's caused the department a lot of problems, because sometimes you will have people abstaining, and they have to be counted as well as the no votes and the yes votes. And the percentages don't work out properly.
Why are they abstaining?
Well,
I mean, instead of no.
I think one reason why is that they feel they don't have enough information about the person to make a no.
Hmm. I'm trying to think whether I've heard of that being done in the history department.
Well, this has been true throughout many departments where they've set down either two-thirds or whatever it is of those voting, or 80% or some other thing, which gets a little messy when you're on the borderline.
Mm.
And this has meant that a lot of potential staff members have not been voted in simply because there has not been this agreement in the department, which, or consensus maybe is a better word, which was there during the Haugen Raggetts years.
And why isn't it? Why isn't it there?
Well, first of all, I think we're larger. I would say these the faculty in the years of the 50s when Haugen was president was a lot more homogeneous in its views. We have faculty in this is true in a lot of our departments. They are in groups. We have what might be called the kineticists, the theoretical group, the practical group, the others. I'm sure this is true in other
departments. Yes, it is.
Departments.
Every department.
And the more you get that kind of a division, the harder it is to agree on anyone. And I've seen this happen almost as badly in mechanical engineering,
mm-hmm.
maybe true in the other departments. So, and it reflects the tremendous expansion of technology. There are fields of chemical engineering in existence today that weren't even present in the 50s, simply because, let's take the computers being one of the great impacts. You've got people that are very much in the area of what you call modelers. They like to model chemical systems and use the computer. That's one group where you'll have the kineticists, those that are interested in reaction theories and thermal, or the practical engineers, they call them, ones that like to teach the practice of the profession rather than the theory. And it takes a great deal of skill on the part of a chairman to orchestrate that kind of difference in viewpoint and have the department come to some decision as to, now we should go in this direction, we should look for somebody with.
Well, are you cohesive enough so you can decide whether you're after the best man in whatever field he may be, or that you want to replace a particular position?
I think they're cohesive on the question of quality,
mm-hmm.
on the best. That's one virtue of a department that's strong.
Mm-hmm.
It generally will not get into a situation of hiring somebody that is not.
You have the choices.
Strong. And I think there is a feeling that given two people, one that may be interested in an area that you think is important but doesn't appear strong, if you have a very strong person, they'll go with a strong person on the assumption that that person will do the right thing in terms of the research and teaching, developing.
Yeah, well, that's a big issue in departments as to which they'll do. I think we're coming to the end of this tape under the circumstances. Whoops. In December of 1947.
Well, yes, the period is not logical, obviously, because one normally starts at a university in the beginning of the semester in the summer. The trouble was, once I informed DuPont that I was to leave, they said, fine, get ready and get out in 2 weeks. And of course, the reason why that happens, and that's true in so many other companies, is that they do not want you to have any more information about their processes or confidential activities than you already possess. And that meant that if you stayed around, you would be doing nothing. And therefore, it was a bit of a surprise to Professor Haugen when I told him I was going to arrive in the middle of December. This meant that for nearly a semester, I would be marking time in the department because all the teaching had been arranged for. And in a certain respect, it was a rather nice way to get into teaching because I'd have several months in which to get settled and underway. What did happen was that I inherited about 5 graduate students in the first semester from Professor Haugen, who decided that several graduate students that he had I should supervise. And from that standpoint, I guess I started rather significantly into research programs, which at one time ended up where I had 13 graduate students working for the PhD. Since some of these were well along, it wasn't that much of a chore. But that's when it all began, and I usually figure in 1948 is about the time my career at Madison began again.